The Family Album, a study sponsored by the President's Committee on Mental Retardation. In 1966, a book called Christmas in Purgatory took us inside institutions like this one for mentally retarded people. In those days, very few people were permitted to visit such places, and no one was permitted to take photographs. These pictures were taken with a concealed camera for that book. Behind the locked doors were conditions of human life that were neither human nor life. It was apparent why official policy kept institutional life a secret. In a world without hope, people were held captive and isolated from everything that our society likes to stand for. A monotony of passing time was the best the institution offered. And in so-called day rooms, many people were naked, walking in excrement, cared for only to the extent of being hosed down and fed. The environment of tile or terrazzo was designed for ease of cleaning, not for human habitation. In many dormitories, anonymous beds were so densely packed that one had to walk over them to pass across the room. And there were people who never had the opportunity to even leave their beds. A lifetime in a crib without love or attention beyond cleaning and feeding. If there was education going on in the institution, it was a preparation for the senselessness of the day room, learning to do nothing. For many people of all ages, therapy and education consisted of being immobilized. 10 years after these pictures were taken, we returned to the world of institutions for mentally retarded people. The pictures that follow show what we found in 1976. We found that there are changes. There are now scenes in which people work to help children grow and learn, in settings which didn't exist 10 years ago. There are now classrooms where children are learning basic skills, rather than merely being tied to chairs. A therapist showing kindness and concern for a severely disabled child can be found far more frequently today. But the good news doesn't go very far. There are more classroom-like classrooms now, but there is a strangeness permeating many of the improvements. Here, no one is wearing socks, and the child by the wall is wearing a black sneaker on one foot and a white one on the other. Maybe because large institutions still practice this kind of mass housekeeping. A practice with which individuality has to suffer. There are today undeniably more children working at genuine learning tasks than there used to be. But at least as common today are classrooms which don't look very educational, classrooms in which children choose to hide under tables, and too many classrooms in which nothing is going on. The good news for children in institutions today is that the news is no longer all bad. They live in less brutal circumstances, probably receive a bit more education. But sometimes when the education results in being restrained in a so-called time-out corner on the floor, it's hard to say whether attention like this is better than no attention at all. And as long as there remain insensitive teachers who can advertise the expectation that their pupils will be profoundly retarded all day, can we expect the situation to improve? For adults, too, there have been changes. Scenes like this didn't often occur 10 years ago. Stores like this are new, and the money to shop at them is more equitably available. In many institutions, there now appear such rather pleasant rooms as this. This probably doesn't resemble your room, but it's a far cry from the scene 10 years ago. The remaining institutional craziness is the railing which keeps one from falling from the bed into the wall. And one of the most important changes is shown by this woman's achievement. She won the right to represent her fellow residents at meetings of institutional officials. 10 years ago, her claim to rights or representation would have been impossible and unintelligible. There is far more effort at vocational education and training for adults. We can wonder whether pegboards are very vocational, but it is some change from the past. 10 years ago, playing children's games on the floor was called vocational education. Who can deny that sorting play money is closer to real work? Certainly it is close enough for institutional real work, The work which is available in these shops seems to be at its most advanced with such contracts as this. Gather 10 drapery hooks and put them in a plastic bag. From the attitudes of most workers, it seems clear that they're bored and nearly idle doing work like this, that they could master more complex tasks. But the few available contracts are always for jobs that no one else wants to do. In addition, each job has been stretched to involve as many workers as possible. The result is for each worker a watered-down task which neither requires nor permits the development of higher skills. Often, the sense of purpose has been lost. The conveyor belt here is quite unnecessary. The little boxes could just as well be passed along by hand. But what has been created is the simulation of work, of life. Busy work has been made to look like a factory. And this unreality of many of the changes seems to permeate life in the institution today. Even where rooms are presumably normalized, with carpets, wallpaper, comfortable furniture, and a modern building, there is the sense of an incomplete, a simulated reality. In one way or another, each institution leaves telltale signs around showing that the expectations of ordinary life don't apply here, such as table lamps in the middle of a room with their cords wrapped around the base because there are no electrical outlets available, or mysterious cupboards. Does it contain a fire hose, inflammables, or drugs? Or steps marching into a chain-link fence? Sometimes the split with reality is done on a grand scale. This award-winning playground cost $300,000, but its hazards proved to be too dangerous for even the most agile individuals to play in. It had to be closed and eventually repaired at a cost of $60,000. Surrounded by such innovations, people pass the time with nothing to do, waiting, nodding off. In the places where such new and improved facilities have been provided, things are tidy and efficient. One can rest along the plainly marked new hallways, rest from the waiting, and wait some more. But it becomes clear that whether we look down the new hallways or these old ones, which are still common today, the quality of life is pretty much the same. Down the old hallways, the furniture is often not so comfortable, but the occupation of those who sit on it is the same. They, too, are waiting, merely passing time. 10 years ago, this room was crowded and the people were ill-clothed, if clothed at all. Feces were everywhere, occasionally to be hosed down the drain and the tile floor. Today, it is clean. Most of the people wear ordinary clothes, although some of them wear clothes in unordinary ways. Apparently, it's considered normal enough just to be wearing clothes, even if they're on backwards. 10 years ago, this drain was used for the hose down. It has to be considered an improvement that today it is merely an ornament in the floor of the Spartan dormitory room. And 10 years ago, one was less likely to find such a warm smile on the face of an attendant in these day rooms, in the midst of what seems like utter hopelessness. But there are other attendants today whose approach is still much less affectionate to those who haven't learned a crucial institutional lesson. The lesson of sitting around, passing the time unobtrusively. In a place where the toy chest is a garbage can, children eventually get the point. Eventually, they must conform to the institutional goal. They must settle into a life of passing time. A persistent feeling that overwhelmed us at times on our visits to these strange places was the feeling of isolation, of aloneness of the people we saw. Even with doors open, or in hallways, each person seems to be apart and solitary. Against the blank modern walls, or in the old tiled day rooms, in outdoor playgrounds, on indoor merry-go-rounds, over and over again, people are utterly alone. Old people and young people. Crowds of alone people. Isolation is the predominant mood. As though for companionship, one frequently sees televisions going, even when no one can see the screen. Amid the gadgets that are supposed to amuse one, children can be abandoned to their own devices. When they grow up, they will be prepared for the solitude of adulthood, waiting for lunch, just waiting for nothing. Of course, one reason for the psychological isolation might be the physical lack of it. In most institutional settings, one is always part of a group. The facilities are designed so that no one can ever pass out of sight. Even quite private activities are in full view from the day room where this picture was taken. Toilets have always been and continue to be a means by which institutions have excluded their residents from the amenities of civilization. This scene with no seat, no toilet paper is still common. It's interesting that rather rigorous institutional health regulations don't prohibit the storage of toothbrushes and other personal hygiene items right over unflushed toilets. But we do find the crushed roll of toilet paper on the ledge. There seems to be no end to the institution's ingenuity in creating crazy toilets. This one has rails and a cover, but no seat, and of course no toilet paper. And here we find a seat and handrails, but to ask for paper is still too much. The institution works in a mysterious way. It habitually looks after strange details and overlooks what often seems more obvious. This woman's hands are carefully covered, but her body is not. And in a world of purposeless sitting and waiting, the institution offers the option of purposeless peddling. So perhaps in accommodation to all this, the people who live here seem to have withdrawn to themselves. Even where they might keep each other company, they choose separate benches. Sitting alone. Standing alone. Ignoring even their doll. Shutting the world out of sight. In what seemed to us situations of despair, it was remarkable to find many people who were not psychologically defeated. We saw people who could smile and greet us with friendship. We met people who looked us and the world in the eye. We wondered how we would look if we had to live in their world. Much of the effort at improving institutions has been applied to sleeping arrangements. This dormitory looks about as pleasant as one could make such a place. Quite often, though, the effort hasn't made a difference that makes a difference. The ornament of Big Bird doesn't make much impact on the dreariness, and certainly is inappropriate for the adults who live here. Federal regulations, which now discourage the large open dormitories, have led to the creation of these so-called modular units. Presumably, this approximates a private room. But places like this are also to be found. Everything is tiled except the mattresses. It might make a good public toilet or subway station, but the institution calls this a cottage. Sleeping is important because for many it is still a way of life, starting in infancy, although it isn't always in bed. While staff sit to one side, children are laid out on mats and left. Elsewhere, older children choose their own place to lie around, under tables, under the sun. Many seem resigned to it. To some, the bed seems to be their whole life, their whole world. Perhaps because beds and bedding are so important in the institution, laundry is also very important and constitutes a major industry. We were told that this institutional laundry plant that they wash 2.3 million pounds of laundry each year. Apparently, running efficient laundries is one thing that institutions are good for. Beds like this are still around too, but seem to be seldom used anymore. It seems possible that the availability of drugs has reduced the need for physical restraints to calm people down. For whatever reason, no visible restraints seem needed to keep people lying down, or calmly sitting half-naked in so-called normalized rooms with birch logs in the fireplace. In a world of endless monotony, people can just drop across their beds and it makes no less sense than anything else. Even in the middle of the day, these people's lives are such that sleeping is as good a thing to do as any. The rules for living in an institution or the rules of an alien world. After a decade of reform and improvement, there is still no life in institutions for mentally retarded people. One of the alternatives is the same one there was 10 years ago. Physically, the Seaside Regional Center in Connecticut is certainly more like an old institution than a new alternative. But within it, human concerns continue to overcome the appearance. Education is carefully planned to meet genuine needs. It involves even the most seriously handicapped individuals. In the sheltered workshops, the range of available jobs includes a good deal more than make work. However, as Seaside has believed throughout its existence, alternatives like this are preferable. People should live in homes if at all possible, and Seaside is making more and more homes like this available to the people of its region. In all the areas we visited, the alternative of community living is becoming more common. We found everywhere a growing minority of mentally retarded people living in ordinary houses in ordinary neighborhoods. When a child can greet a visitor in surroundings like this, the advantages of community options seem clear. And yet not clear enough. These boys were taken from an institution and placed in a foster home. Here they can ride a motorcycle and do the things that boys do. But for them, this life may be temporary. They were placed in this setting because a new institution needed to be built. They're not off the hook. While they thrive, construction proceeds on a permanent placement. So we find that while there is a principle of normalization in evidence, the principle of abnormalization remains active. One reason why institutions haven't profited more from the lessons of normalized community alternatives may be that they move so slowly. These small living units seemed like the answer when they were being planned. 10 years later, they're just being completed, but are already obsolete. There are merely many small buildings at an institution which used to have a few big ones. And there continue to be people and states who believe that protective institutions should continue to be built. Like this one, with a vast network of covered walkways to protect everyone from the rain. Environments like this are still believed to be necessary for mentally retarded people, in spite of the many successful and attractive alternatives. One of the most strikingly attractive alternatives is illustrated by Camp Hill Village, a community in which more than 50 mentally retarded people live. People are busy, and they are busy with meaningful work. This bread will be shared by all the people of the village, and this baker was obviously proud as he offered to teach us his trade if we should choose to stay at Camp Hill. Work at the village is shared equally by all residents, of whom about half would be considered handicapped elsewhere. Many of the products of the village are sold to supplement income, which is also shared by all. There is a useful place here for everyone. This man's job is to hold the cow's tail to calm her and make the milking easier. The people of Camp Hill have chosen to use technology in such a way that it doesn't displace people. After the hand milking, modern equipment pasteurizes and refrigerates the milk. Many values are different here. There are no television sets, but books circulate widely and are held in esteem. This librarian was sure we would want a picture not of her, but of the books. What Camp Hill Village shows is that a life like this is possible for people labeled mentally retarded. That a scene like this could replace this scene from 1966. Yet, in the 10 years since this picture was taken, all we have achieved in institutions is this. The lessons of normalization, of the group home experience, of Camp Hill and other alternatives seem to have done nothing to affect institutional life, apart from cleaner rooms, less nakedness. Now we know that mealtime can be a time of sharing, affection, and community. But the institutional mealtime continues to be a feeding time with patrolling attendants. We know, or should know, that people of diverse abilities can work together, share responsibility for taking care of their needs. Yet, the institution doesn't reflect this knowledge. Perhaps it can't. If these mentally retarded people can gather around a kitchen table in the evening to learn about the travels of Alexander the Great, why must this scene continue day in and day out in the institution? We have seen that a man can be by himself, yet not alone, because what he is doing has a place in the life of his community. Yet, in the institution, a man is almost always alone, though surrounded by others. And we have seen that for mentally retarded people, as much as for anyone else, life can have the rhythm of ordinary things, like coming home from work and reading the newspaper. Yet in the institution, there are no ordinary rhythms. There is only monotony, and passing time, and losing hope. There are children growing up in this world without meaning, learning the lessons of hopelessness and resignation, preparing to take the place of generations before them. The news from institutions is not good news.